There'll come a time.
There'll come a time.
When the world won't be singing.
When the world won't be singing.
Flowers won't grow.
Flowers won't grow. No.
Bells won't be ringing.
No bells won't be ringing.
Welcome to the Voices from the Frontline segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour on KPFK Radio, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming on the web for the world at www.kpfk.org. My name is Tammy Bang Lu, and I'm here with my co-host Manuel Criollo. On December 27th, Pakistan's former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto was assassinated in Pakistan while campaigning for a third term. We're going to examine the situation in Pakistan, the U.S. role in the region with Bush administration's war on terror, and what lays ahead. Joining us will be Vijay Prashad, Associate Professor of International Studies at Trinity College. And then we're going to go to Fort Benning's, Georgia, where November 18th of 2007, 25,000 people marched, calling for a closing of the School of the Americas. Initially opened in 1946, the SOA, frequently dubbed the School of the Assassins, has trained over 60,000 Latin American soldiers in counterinsurgency techniques. We're going to be joined by Father Roy Bourgeois, founder of the School of the Americas Watch, while he's here in Los Angeles to keep the momentum going on the growing movement to close down the SOA. Stay tuned and we'll be right back.
We can't stop
when
this.
We can't stop living. Oh, oh.
Live.
Live.
Welcome back to Voices from the Front Lines. Less than 2 weeks ago, December 22nd, Pakistani's former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto was assassinated. Opposition leaders are calling for the resignation of President Musharraf, an ally of the Bush administration. Elections were scheduled for tomorrow, but have been postponed until February 18th. Joining us to discuss the situation in Pakistan is Vijay Prashad, Associate Professor of International Studies at Trinity College and author of several books, including the most recent, Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World, published by New Press. Welcome, Vijay. It's good to have
you
on the show.
Happy New Year,
Tammy. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
Well, I mean, I was thinking, you know, the news, it's Pakistan and Bhutto have been in the news quite frequently over the holidays. But it's also a region where not very many people are familiar with it. You know, it's been seesawing back and forth between military dictatorships and elected governments, with British colonialism and U.S. Imperialism all mixed up in. So, you know, in a couple of minutes, could you give us a primer on Pakistan and the region so that it can get us into talking about the current situation?
Okay, that's great. You know, the first thing people should know is that Pakistan is a country of about 170 million people. Now, put that in context with Iraq, which is also in the news, a country of between 22, 23 million people. Pakistan is a vast population, a very large area, even though you can't tell when you look at most maps. The projections are so poor. It's a very large country. It's a country that's dominated, as a recent book put it, by Aisha Siddiqa, a country dominated by what she calls military ink, military incorporated. In other words, the military has insinuated itself not only into the power structure, but also into the economy. It controls very many sectors of Pakistan's economy. In addition to that, Pakistan is a country that for the last 50 years, there's been very limited attempt to overturn this massive power held by a very small number of families. 29, 30 families dominate the land and, you know, some sectors of the economy. So there's a combination of, you know, a kind of monopoly rule by some families and by the military over this country. Add to that the fact that since the early 1950s, Pakistan has been, you know, off and on a client state of the United States of America. And the United States, from the early 50s, decided to put its hand alongside the hand of the Pakistani military. So you have a situation of 160, 170 million people, where the military plays an overwhelming role in the society, and the United States is allied to the military in Pakistan, has put all its interests with the military, and therefore puts pressure on the military by giving Pakistan, you know, disbursements, some money. You know, in the last 6-7 years, $5 billion has gone to the military. So it's a very skewed situation where you have a large country in the middle of Eurasia, dominated by the military, and the military itself in a relatively subordinate role to what happens in Washington, etc. But let's not also be deluded. Washington doesn't command what occurs in Pakistan. Washington simply puts pressure on the military to do certain things. You know, Pakistanis are not puppets that are manipulated by Washington, D.C. You know, that's the fantasy of the Pentagon. That's the fantasy of Washington, D.C., but that's not the reality. But nonetheless, Washington puts an overwhelming amount of power through the military onto Pakistani society.
Mm. And particularly given it borders, the western border of Pakistan borders Afghanistan.
It not only borders Afghanistan, it also has, proximity to Iran. Pakistan plays a very important geostrategic role and has played that role since, again, as I said, the 1950s. Not only does Pakistan play an important geostrategic role, in other words, in terms of where it's located, abutting Afghanistan, abutting India, which until recently was not a reliable ally for the United States, also abutting Iran. So it has a geostrategic position. But apart from that, Pakistan has played another role for the United States. In the Organization of Islamic States, Pakistan was a reliable ally for the United States to put amendments, to put pressure on the Islamic States in the Organization of Islamic States to vote on behalf of the United States. It's a reliable ally in that community to put forward a certain agenda.
Hmm.
So it plays a geostrategic role in terms of where it's located, but it also plays an important institutional role in the Organization of Islamic States.
Hmm. So then let's move and talk a little bit. It's a primarily a Muslim state, but yet has been ruled historically by secular governments and then you said and the military. So tell us a little bit about the chief of state, Musharraf, and then lead us into who Benazir Bhutto was and the kind of the wing of the democratic struggle that's coming up in Pakistan.
Well, let's flip it the other way around. Let's start with Benazir Bhutto.
Okay.
Benazir Bhutto, you know, it's a tragic thing. She was assassinated at the very, very tender age of 54.
Mm.
54 nowadays is not even a life. But she lived a full life in those 54 years. She was the daughter of Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, very important, charismatic politician who arrived in Pakistan, he came to history as the scion of an important landed family. They owned a very large amount of land. They were very prominent in the economy, their family, and particularly his wife's family, that is Benazir Bhutto's mother. Very, very moneyed, very landed family. But he comes in and plays a role on the left side of a military dictatorship in the 1950s. And disgruntled to some extent with the situation then, there's a lot of details, the battle against East Pakistan, which becomes Bangladesh, set all that aside. He creates a vehicle, the Pakistani People's Party, which was broadly an anti-imperialist socialist platform at the time. And he rides it, you know. He is like, in a sense, Juan Perón, you know, a man also who comes out of the military, although Bhutto wasn't in uniform. He was also, alongside the military, rides this vehicle, mass vehicle, anti-imperialist vehicle, and it was a moment of great hope in Pakistani civil society. He comes up and he brings all these grievances to the fore, but he is crushed now by Ziaul-Haq, who will arrest him, and he is assassinated in jail. So Benazir Bhutto, as a young woman, watched her father, this great mass leader, assassinated in the jails of the military, again with a wink and nod from Washington, D.C., because Zulfikar Ali Bhutto had become too dangerous in a way for Washington, and they returned to the barracks and Zia-ul-Haq comes in, overthrows the democratically elected leader, and seizes power. That dictatorship, the dictatorship of Zia-ul-Haq, not the first dictatorship in Pakistan, but a very consequential one. Because Zia will do at least two things. Of course, he's very pro-American, but he does two important things. One, Zia allows Pakistan to become the front line in the war in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union. Because don't be misled. When the U.S. intervenes in Afghanistan, that intervention has nothing to do with Afghanistan. It had everything to do with the war against the Soviets.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to put pressure on the Soviets. And Zia says, come in, you know, you go ahead. At the same time, Zia will open up the economy by IMF pressure so that certain sectors of the economy are cut back, like, for instance, healthcare and education, sliced under Zia's rule. And finally, the third thing he does in order to consolidate power is he starts a process known as Islamization, to Islamize the secular constitution of Pakistan. So this process that occurs has immense consequences. You see, what happens once you say the state should not finance education, for the elite, it's okay, the elite anyway can pay for education, go abroad, etc. For the lower middle class and the working class, this is a death sentence. Suddenly, though, as the state withdraws from providing education through IMF pressure, money arrives from Saudi Arabia, money arrives from even the United States, and you have the growth of a whole series of religious schools, madrasas. Madrasas, by and large, are not some, you know, diabolical thing. They provide some measure of education. But for the lower middle class and the working class, these become a kind of salvation. But these are not ordinary madrasas. These are not ordinary religious schools. These are religious schools of the far right. So, in a sense, under Zia, who was the creature of Washington, D.C., you have the beginning of the Islamization of Pakistan and Pakistan becoming more firmly under U.S. Control. Now, when Benazir, during the Zia years, is in exile, and from exile, she sees that there is no way anybody can lead Pakistan and not be supported by the United States. In 1984, she makes her first move to make a sort of alliance with Washington, D.C. This was reported by her friend Peter Galbraith. She makes her first visit, and from 84 onwards, she comes every year for a pilgrimage to Washington, D.C. She spends, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars lobbying in D.C. And in Washington, D.C., this daughter of the East, in a sense, becomes a daughter of the West. And finally, you know, she becomes prime minister in 1993. It's an appalling period, because when there was a possibility of doing something, she moves to the right. You know, she begins to talk about Islam in a way that is consonant with Islamization. She promotes IMF kind of positions, and very importantly, she becomes, in the hands of Washington, D.C. Now, she's removed from office partly because of corruption allegations. Her husband was known as Mr. 10%. He was Asif Zardari, so they fled the country. Musharraf comes to power in 1999 because the military, in a sense, were fed up with almost a decade of civilian rule. They return because they have a habit of leaving the barracks. That habit is ingrained. They control so much of the economy that if there's any economic chaos, they want to come in and shore up their position. I mean, after all, this is not, again, political intervention. It's also for them economic. Musharraf comes in. And under pressure from Washington in 2007, he felt that they needed some kind of civilian fig leaf. And Benazir was going to provide that. I mean, she returns to Pakistan this year, just as she returned in 1986. But in 1986, she returned in a different way. She still had cachet. She still had, you know, there was still hope vested in her. When she returned this time, there was still cachet. But the only hope that was vested in her was the hope of otherwise futility. In other words, the tragedy of Pakistan today is that Benazir, well known as somebody who wouldn't carry water for popular aspirations, was one that people put their hopes in because it seemed that everything else was so bleak. And that is why there is universal grief at the assassination of Benazir Bhutto.
We're speaking with Vijay Prashadi, schooling us on what's going on in Pakistan. You know, let's move into talking a little bit about Musharraf. I mean, he takes the state of emergency last November, kicked out a lot of the Supreme Court, moving into somewhat of a martial law. And a lot of the forces are saying, you know, like, who stands to gain with Bhutto's death? And it was Musharraf. At the same time where the U.S. is trying to increase presence in Pakistan, I think it was the New York Times today was saying that Musharraf and Bhutto were going to allow direct intervention by U.S. forces. So what does that leave open right now with the elections being postponed from what was going to be yesterday to February 18th?
Well, I mean, let's go back a little bit. Is this good for Musharraf? You know, the surprising thing is the New York Times has now taken William Kristol, who is one of the intellectual defenders of the Iraq war, as a columnist. And Bill Kristol recently said that he feels the Bush administration is going to act in Pakistan. You know, forget Iran and all that. That's a distraction. Act in Pakistan within a month or two, which is a kind of chilling thing to hear that the U.S. wants to have. I mean, what does it mean to act in Pakistan? To, again, launch some missiles into Waziristan? You know, that would be insane. The last time that occurred, it simply inflamed the area. There is already incredible feeling against the United States. So I don't understand what their strategic sense is. It seems to me that their calculation is the following. The United States knows that its main ally is the military. And it recognizes that Musharraf was simply useful when he was the military. Musharraf has become something of a clown now. So today in the New York Times, Carlotta Gall, writing from Pakistan, did a profile of the current head of the military, Kiani, who is also, by the way, a very good golfer, and is the head of the Pakistan Golf Association.
And trained at Fort Benning, Georgia.
Exactly, trained at Fort Benning, Georgia. So the feeling is that the U.S. would like the military to remain in charge. So Musharraf is not relevant to them. You know, he doesn't realize that. He thinks, I believe, that he is the, you know, Pakistani Kemal Ataturk, that he is important. But to the Pentagon and to the White House, it's the military that's the important institution. So it's very likely that a deal will be reached, he will disappear, and some other strong person will come forward. It's very unlikely that the United States would like to see a genuine election in Pakistan because the net result may not be what they like, you know. I'm not saying it will become like Palestine, in other words, where Hamas won the election. It's very unlikely that the political Islamists will win an election. You know, the two mass parties are not quite the parties of Fazlur Rahman and others of Waziristan. The two mass parties are not of that character, but nonetheless, they are not quite, they may not be as quite pro-American as the military. So that's, as I see it, is that there must be a lot of phones ringing in the general HQ, in the general headquarters, you know, trying to reach some generals or the other to figure out what's happening.
So I know that some colonists have been talking about that there was a real strong movement around the intelligentsia and the streets calling for democratic rule, particularly around pushing Musharraf and looking for a democratically elected government. So what happened? And bringing her in was some way to kind of quell what was going off from the ground up. What force is there, party or another form, that can speak for the social needs of the bulk of the people in Pakistan? And with the elections coming up February 18th, who's moving in? The previous Prime Minister, Nawaz Sharif, you got Musharraf. So could you talk to us a little bit about where is some of the hope inside Pakistan, and what do you think the results of the elections are going to be?
Oh, the you know, one cannot underestimate this year and a half of absolute protests in the streets, led by lawyers, led by human rights activists, led by, you know, small left groupuscules, etc. All this stuff was extremely important. It shook up the regime. It shook up the country at large, the society at large. You have to add to that as well, on the same page, the protests from the Islamists, in other words, at the Red Mosque in the center of Islamabad. You may not like people's politics, but nonetheless, they were forcefully protesting against the regime. So from the left, from the right, there was a very big assault on the Pakistani state. That was very impressive and very important. But one must bear in mind that some of the main leaders, at least in the liberal protests, were associated with the political, the mainstream political parties. One of the main lawyers, for instance, one of the leading lawyers, was once the interior minister in Benazir Bhutto's government in the 1990s. So, the energy of that mass upsurge was going to be thrown in the direction of particularly Benazir Bhutto. It had become clear that would be the dynamic. If she called out her supporters against the regime, the streets would have been filled, The political parties, particularly Benazir Bhutto's party and Nawaz Sharif's party, they command the street. Lawyers had protests, etc., but they are not mass entities. So at this moment, it's very unclear what the situation would be. Nawaz Sharif was a creation of the Pakistani state, and he now has some distance from Musharraf because he was removed from power by Musharraf. But I don't think he has any sense that the structure needs to be changed. He is a creature of that structure. So the hope in Pakistan, of course, rests in gradual understanding that some alternatives need to be created.
So, related to this, not to digress a little, but the region of Pashtun, the tribal areas in the northwestern region of Pakistan where you have the area where the nuclear weapons are maintained, it's, the area that borders Afghanistan, it's close to Russia and China, they've been calling for a nationalist movement. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how does that play into the equation?
This is in Balochistan.
Yes.
Now, Balochistan has had about maybe, 50 years of secessionist protest against the Pakistani state. This is a very old protest. It's a fight on several accounts. But recently, the sharp edge of the disagreement has been over resources. That Baluchis feel that they have been treated as extraneous to the Pakistani state, and yet their resources of energy resources particularly are siphoned off for the rest of the country. So that has been the main sharp edge of the current displeasure. And those movements, in the 60s, they were all Marxist movements, by and large. But they were the interesting kind of Marxist movements led by feudal chiefs.
Mm.
Some of those chiefs continue to wield power. And, they have been engaged in armed struggle. It's a brave movement. But this is a very old struggle. It's a 50-year-old struggle. There's no likelihood that secession is going to be on the table, and the Baluch movement is treated, it's interesting, even in the main cities of Pakistan where there are these urban protests, the link with the Baluch movement is very weak.
You're listening to Voices from the Front Lines Radio on 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and we're speaking with Vijay Prashad on the situation in Pakistan. Here we go. On the one hand, we've been talking a lot about just what the future holds for Pakistan. On the one instance, you were saying that the United States would love nothing else than the military moving in, and they've already picked, the successor, which is the current general, Kayani. But in the other instance, I think what we're saying is what's best for the Pakistani is to disengage in the U.S. war on terrorism and start looking at how they can play this kind of neutral role between Washington and the Taliban and start building a country. So what forces are actually pushing for that either neutral relationship to the United States and or then trying to craft, some type of alternative?
Well, there are two things that need to be demanded immediately. One is some kind of balanced, this is a very difficult way to phrase, but some sort of maybe judicious use of force. in Waziristan and in the territories. You know, if you're going to if the state is going to make an assessment that there are political Islamists that have you know, using terror wantonly against the population, you can't come out there heavy-handedly and arrest everybody and, you know, use artillery fire and such, because you inflame regions. You have to be judicious. There has to be a measured response. That's the first thing. Secondly, neither the Pakistani state nor, you know, the United States or anybody has tried in that border region to do any infrastructural development. You know, there's this theory that it's an autonomous region. It's been largely abandoned. But, of course, this abandonment is not ancient. It's a very modern abandonment. It's a deal that the state made. I should say that, you know, over 50 years ago, there was a very important fight in that region, a left-wing fight in Pashtun region, in the Pashtun-speaking area, in part in Afghanistan, part in Pakistan, where there was a man who was known as the Frontier Gandhi, Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan. He was a very important leader in the area, socialist, secular-minded, you know, led a mass movement for freedom against British rule in the Pashto-speaking areas. During the barbaric civil war of the 1980s that tore through that region, when Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan died, all sides stopped fighting so that his coffin could come to Kandahar. You know, there are all kinds of lineages even in that region. And what it requires is, it requires some kind of political force that's able to, one, pull that lineage out and put it before the people, you know, say that we are the heirs of Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan. Secondly, to say that if there are people who are wantonly using violence against us, not against somebody else, against us, then we need to deal with them so that our community can be reconstructed. And thirdly, there needs to be some agenda for schooling, healthcare, etc. That has been totally forgotten.
Hmm. Thank you so much, Vijay Prashad. You know, just quickly, I mean, a lot of people are trying to figure out if they wanted to continue to keep abreast of what's going on in Pakistan. Are there any important thinkers or, you know, people in writing from the region that people should be following?
Well, there is my colleague from Himal Magazine, Beena Sarwar, S-A-R-W-A-R.
S-A-R-W-A-R, Beena.
Yeah, that's her last name. First name is Beena. One must read her. She is absolutely legible, a brilliant person. Then, very happily for me, Counterpunch, the website, has been carrying some superb pieces from Pakistan and from the Pakistani diaspora. So people, if they follow counterpunch.org, you'll get your fill of Pakistan.
All right. So look up Beena Sarwar and Counterpunch. We were talking to Vijay Prashad. He's the Associate Professor of International Studies at Trinity College. And everybody should get his book, Darker Nations, The People's History of the Third World. Stay tuned, and we'll be back with Father Roy Bourgeois on the struggle to close down the School of the Americas.
Welcome back to Voices from the Frontlines on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. On November 18th, over 25,000 marched on Fort Benning, Georgia, calling to close the School of the Americas, now known as the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. The SOA, frequently called the School of Assassins, was opened in 1946 and has trained over 60,000 Latin American soldiers and leaders in counterinsurgency techniques. We are joined today by Father Roy Bourgeois, founder of the School of the Americas Watch, while here in Los Angeles to keep the momentum going of the growing movement to close down the School of the Americas. Welcome to the show, Father Bourgeois.
It's good to be with you, Manuel.
Well, why don't we, I had a chance to go through your book, Disturbing the Peace, that came out a couple of years ago, and wow, I've followed your, followed the movement, because my parents are from El Salvador. I was very surprised about your background. I think why don't we spend a little bit of time to give our listeners some time about your own life history and what led you to come to this point where, you know, you're leading one of the most important movements against the U.S. military, and particularly the movement to close the School of the Americas?
Sure. Well, I, you know, like most, a product of my experiences, I grew up in a small town in Louisiana, working class family. We were cut off from a bigger world. We didn't critique U.S. foreign policy. We considered ourselves very patriotic. Went to the state university, got a degree in geology, hoping to get rich in the oil fields of perhaps Venezuela one day. When I left college, Vietnam was on, and it was very easy for me to join the military. I became a naval officer. In a way, it was my ticket out of Louisiana. And then for the next 4 years, I was in the military. I traveled quite a bit, 2 years aboard ship, went to a NATO station in Europe for a year, and then volunteered for shore duty in Vietnam. I believed the lies back then. I was the product of a whole lot of, ignorance. I've actually come to see the greatest enemy in our country today, and I speak from personal experience in my own life. We're very ignorant about other countries, our foreign policy in these countries, other cultures, histories of countries so much older than our own. But I went to Vietnam believing the cause was noble, that we were going to be the liberators, the same language they gave us that they use for Iraq. And I bought into it. But Vietnam was that turning point in my life. The violence there, I'd never seen that kind of poverty, that kind of violence before. I lost friends there. I was wounded there. I was shaken. Death was very close. And what I thought about most of all, really, was what my death would mean to my close-knit family in the bayous of Louisiana. I look forward to getting out of there. It was hell. And what happened was I started to change. In Vietnam, I met a Catholic priest, a missionary, near our base, caring for over 500 children at this orphanage, and just doing volunteer work there with my friends convinced me that I wanted to change the course in my life. I wanted to try and be a peacemaker. When I left Vietnam, I entered the Maryknoll community, the Catholic priesthood. Maryknoll is a group that works in 25 countries around the world serving the poor. I was later ordained a Catholic priest and went to serve the poor of Bolivia, where this slum on the outskirts of La Paz now became my home for the next 5 years. And really it was here, Manuel, where I got educated by the poor that I went there to serve. They became my teachers. And little by little, not overnight, but they began to teach me, this very ignorant gringo, about my country's foreign policy. And all I can say is it was an awakening. I was very, very angry and sad to see my country in Bolivia supporting a brutal dictator, but not only in Bolivia. This was in El Salvador. This was in Chile, Honduras, Argentina, and so many countries, Chile. And little by little, I really now began to see life through the eyes and the experience of the poor, the oppressed, the victims of our country's foreign policy. And it was in my fifth year that I was arrested in Bolivia, forced out of the country, came home. It was a very difficult time in my life. I couldn't return. I tried to get back to Bolivia. They wouldn't give me a visa. So I became now very involved in El Salvador and this issue of the U.S. Army School of the Americas. When I came back, let me just say how I, you know, what brought us to Fort Benning, Georgia, where I'm presently living right outside of the main gate of Fort Benning, home of what was known for many years as the School of the Americas. But when I came back from Bolivia, again, not able to go back, forced out, I went to El Salvador. I had never seen anything like El Salvador. It reminded me of Vietnam. In fact, I was more frightened in El Salvador than I was in Vietnam. I've never seen such brutality, such violence being done to the poor. Archbishop Oscar Romero had just been assassinated. Four U.S. churchwomen, two of them were friends, nuns of the Maronil Order, were raped and killed by the soldiers of El Salvador. And what I found in El Salvador, as many of us did, was our country, the United States, once again giving guns and military aid to those soldiers during the killing. I came back from El Salvador, as many of us did, and could not shut up. I protested. I spoke out in churches and colleges. And when 500 soldiers from El Salvador came down to Fort Benning to start their combat training here on U.S. soil, I, you know, called friends. A small group of us came to Fort Benning and said, not in our name. And we entered Fort Benning at night. We dressed, three of us, dressed as high-ranking Army officers. We went near the barracks of the Salvadoran soldiers on Fort Benning, where they were, you know, being trained in the art of killing, and this is the role of the military, to be trained in the art of killing. And we went near their barracks, and we had with us this powerful boombox, and it was the last sermon in Spanish of Archbishop Oscar Romero, his sermon given in the cathedral there in San Salvador, the day before he was assassinated, where he made his special plea to the men in the military, saying to them, stop the killing, lay down your weapons, disobey your superior officers telling you to kill your fellow campesinos, and obey a higher law that says thou shall not kill. So we scaled this tall pine tree near the barracks. When the last lights went out, we just said, Bishop Romero, this is for you, brother. Mm-hmm. And we boomed his voice into the barracks, and, of course, that got us in big trouble. We were arrested. We were brought to trial and then sent to prison for a year and a half. And I can only say that we went to prison, seeing this as a humble act of solidarity with sisters and brothers of Latin America who were being killed by graduates of this School of the Americas here at Fort Benning. Prison, I want to say, was a place where I learned that they could not silence us. We spoke from prison. The truth can't be silenced. When I got out of prison, I must say, went back to work, but we could not stop the violence in El Salvador. The military aid increased. It got up to over $1 million a day. And then they went after the Jesuits there in El Salvador, the Jesuits at the university. They were telling the world about what was going on in this little country, El Salvador. The military, November the 16th, 1989, entered the campus of the Jesuits in El Salvador, and after midnight dragged these six Jesuits, most of them scholars, out of their rooms, with them a young mother, their co-worker, and her teenage daughter, Selena. And they were massacred. They were shot at close range. This made the front pages of our newspapers, and it really angered so many of us. And what happened, a U.S. Congressional Task Force went to El Salvador to investigate, came back reporting that those responsible were trained in the United States at a big army base called Fort Benning in Georgia, and at the U.S. Army School of the Americas. When I read that report, I decided now to come to Fort Benning once again to really investigate and do research on the U.S. Army School of the Americas. I was joined by friends, Charlie Litke from San Francisco, Vietnam vet, recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor, a Jesuit priest, a couple of other Vietnam vets. We had 10 of us. And what we learned, what we discovered here at Fort Benning, was a school of assassins. And that was years ago. I've been here ever since. We started with a group of 10, and as you mentioned, Manuel, this past November, we had over 25,000 who gathered at the main gate. And the reason we are here and the reason I continue to live outside of the main gate of Fort Benning is to really try to close a U.S. military school that every year trains over 1,000 soldiers from 18 countries in Latin America in military skills, that really leads to a lot of suffering and death in Latin America.
We're talking to Father Roy Bourgeois, founder of the School of the Americas Watch, and he's sharing a little bit of an amazing story. Again, as I've told you, I've definitely followed the movement, mainly because one of my main sort of elders here is Maria Guardado, which I'm assuming you know. She's a she was a former person who got tortured in Salvador, and and I think that, you know, it's such an amazing movement, because I think that, as you were saying, that a lot of the more progressive movement in the United States who support the struggle to end the war in Salvador has now been able to at least find a very good target, which has been the School of the Americas. Good enough so that, in fact, now they've not only changed the name of the school, but more importantly, as I know from the last vote, there was only 11 votes short in Congress to actually stop the funding of the School of the Americas. Why don't we talk a little bit about how is it looking in that particular struggle? Not only obviously the main direct action that's been going on for years, but now also the struggle that's happening in the Congress.
Yes, we realized just after being here a couple of years and you know, organizing and trying to build a movement to close the school, we realized that we had to go to Washington. They control the purse strings. So, you know, this school was being financed by millions of dollars, all coming from our tax money. So we headed to Washington, and I remember we fasted for 40 days, a juice-only fast on the steps of the Capitol, and really got the attention of people like Representative Joe Kennedy, Joe Moakley, who headed the Congressional Task Force to El Salvador. And they started to vote on this issue, and we had a lot of work to do. And as the movement grew, thousands coming into the movement, we would go to Washington every spring and knock on those congressional doors and write thousands of letters over the years. And sure enough, each time they voted, we got closer and closer. And like you said, this last vote, actually we lost by 6. That was back in June. And we are going to have another vote in Congress this year, perhaps in a couple of months. So very important if our listeners could simply write their members of Congress saying that you don't want your tax money going into funding a school, again, that is an obstacle to democracy. So the lobbying, the legislative work is a very, very big issue for us, very important. That coupled, actually, in a way, there are like three pillars of our SOA Watch movement. The huge November vigil, when thousands come here from around the country. This last November, I would say over half of those who came from all over the country, many from California, over half were high school and college students. That's given us a lot of hope. This school, I must say, has become somewhat of a teaching moment for us. We can look at this school at Fort Benning, now called the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, and really learn a lot about U.S. foreign policy in Latin America. While they talk about teaching democracy here, it's really about providing the muscle in Latin America for U.S. foreign policy and protecting, of course, the U.S. economic interest of the United States there. Having been in the military, so many in our movement were in the military, are now a big part of our movement, we certainly ask a basic question. How do you teach democracy to these soldiers, you know, at a military base in an institution, the U.S. Army, that's not democratic? How do you teach democracy behind the barrel of a gun? I live right outside of the main gate. There are two fences surrounding Fort Benning, topped with barbed wire, signs that say no trespassing. And, of course, the basic question that we ask is how do you teach democracy in this setting? This is not about democracy. This is about control. Another pillar of our movement, along with, you know, the lobbying, is our Latin America initiative. A couple years ago, we went to Venezuela and met with President Hugo Chavez to talk about severing Venezuela's ties to this school, who had sent over 4,000 of their troops here. And after a meeting with President Chavez, he did say he would have to talk and consult with his ministers. But 3 weeks later, we got official word from Venezuela that they were cutting off all participation in this military school. And that really, having Venezuela withdraw from the school, encouraged us now to begin what we call our Latin America initiative. We said, let's go to all of these countries and meet with their country's leaders, human rights leaders, indigenous leaders, and request that they too sever their ties. And I'm happy to report that after visiting some 13 countries over this last year, we now have 5 countries who have cut off, you know, all involvement in the school, and that's Bolivia, Argentina, Uruguay, Costa Rica, and, of course, Venezuela. And, of course, now next month we're going to Nicaragua and then Ecuador. It's our hope that little by little we'll get more and more countries to simply say no to this school.
We have on the phone Father Roy Bourgeois. And also for folks who are listening, you know, Father Bourgeois is going to be here in Los Angeles. You're going to do a big tour, as I know, and you're going to be a whole set of events out here in Southern California. At least for the moment, let's try to highlight two. One is tomorrow, Tuesday, January the 8th at 7 p.m., Father Bourgeois is going to be at the United Church of Santa Monica. And also an important event, which is going to be on Saturday, which is a vigil on January the 12th at 11 a.m. at the Los Angeles State Historic Park at 1245 North Spring Street here in Los Angeles. If people who want more information can call 310-838-8131. Well, Father Bourgeois, I think you're right.
Let me just excuse me to interrupt, but yeah, there's been a lot of work. So many organizers working very hard for this vigil, this big gathering at the Los Angeles State Historic Park, mm-hmm. as you mentioned, from 11 a.m. to 4 at 1245 North Spring Street. And I really want to make a special invitation to our listeners to try and go to this gathering Saturday at the Los Angeles State Historic Park. What we're going to do, what the organizers are doing, working very hard at this, is to really duplicate what happens here in November when over 25,000 gathered this last November. We are going to sort of, you know, have a repetition of that in Los Angeles, and I just really want to invite the listeners to come to that big event.
Thank you, Father Bourgeois. I think that it was amazing that the stories of Venezuela and Bolivia and Uruguay, when you think about how, I mean, isn't it, did you feel sort of a full circle there where you went down to Bolivia and now, I'm assuming with Evo Morales coming into power, mm-hmm. Now that they've now extricated themselves from this actual program?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, Manuel, it was going back. You know, I met in the barrio with all friends who are still there struggling along, you know, at our daycare center, the little school. And you know, we reflected. You know, we just thought, you know, we asked, you know, who would have ever thought way back then that we would now have in Bolivia the first indigenous president, how could this be, we thought. We never once dreamed that this would happen. And, you know, we met with Evo, you know, at 5 o'clock in the morning. And it was a very warm meeting. And he did say that it would take time. He didn't give us an immediate answer like Hugo Chavez. But then months later, he did make it official that Bolivia was pulling out of the school. And that, I want to say, what's going on in Latin America? And we could see that in Bolivia, in Venezuela, in Ecuador, and other countries, Argentina, these countries that we've been visiting. This sea change that's taken place in Latin America, countries that have been so dominated by el imperio, the empire. It's amazing how so many people refer to our country, the United States, as the empire, el imperio. And what we heard in Bolivia from Evo Morales, the president there, and all these other presidents and indigenous leaders that we met with is this. We are welcome, our country, the United States, in Latin America, pero como antes, not as before, not as a conquistador to exploit the cheap labor and their natural resources. And what they're saying is that if we want to go in these countries and participate as a partner in their development and building up their country, you know, and really bringing about democracy, we're welcome, but not as before, not as a conquistador. And can we do this as a country? I don't know. Under President Bush, it's not possible. Will our next president, be able to do that? But let me just say, I think we have a lot of work to do. The first thing, of course, is to let our voices be heard about, you know, I'm kind of saddened by Iraq dominating the news so much along with these presidential elections that Latin America is not really on the radar screen now. And our goal, of course, is to keep our sisters and brothers of Latin America, Central America, in the news and to simply let people and our leaders know what we have done to Latin America and Central America in the past and what we continue to do to these countries and the people there by continuing to operate this school of assassins down at Fort Benning, Georgia.
We're talking to Father Roy Bourgeois, founder of the School of the Americas Watch. Well, you know, Father Bourgeois, I mean, we have a couple more minutes, but me and my co-host Tammy Liu were discussing how, you know, in some ways, you're a break of an important generation inside the church, where the church actually stood for something, and you know, it saddens me that there's been a very right wing version of the church now, especially inside the Catholic Church, where in many ways many of the voices, important voices like yourself, are no longer here. Here in Los Angeles, you know, we had Father Olivares, who was very key to our own form of development here in Los Angeles, and it's really sad to see that. But sad, and yet I'm, you know, at the same time very hopeful that you've continued the struggle. And again, I really want to invite folks to go out to all the events that Father Bourgeois is going to be here in Los Angeles for almost the whole week. He's going to go to, you know, if you guys want to go to service, you want to go to a rally, Father Bourgeois is going to be doing a world tour here in Los Angeles. Again, for more information, people can call 310-838-8131. And as Father Bourgeois is saying, there's going to be an important vigil and action on January 12th at 11 a.m. at the Los Angeles State Historic Park. Again, that's 1245 North Spring Street. And folks, you know, you can come and hear this important voice to try to close down this school of the assassins and hopefully raise the broader questions of not only the military strength of the United States, but more importantly, the economic and cultural strength that it's having on the world. Well, with that, Father Bourgeois, again, I really want to thank you, and I'm hoping to get a chance to meet you on this trip. And that's the ends for today's program of Voices from the Frontline. This is your co-host, Manuel Criollo, my co-host was Tammy Bang Liu. We'd like to thank our guests, Vijay Prashad and Father Roy Bourgeois. Today we heard music from Marvin Gaye, Oso Motley, and Ray Barreto. You can listen to previous Voices show at www.thestrategycenter.org and send comments to voices@thestrategycenter.org. We'd like to thank our producer, Christine Blogsdale, and D'Angelo Jones, who is our engineer for today. We'd like to thank our production organizer, Lisa Adler. And we'll see you next week from Voices from the Frontlines. Up next is Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman.